Greetings, ladies and gentlemen. You are listening to the Castorbis podcast with a K, available on Castorbis.com, iTunes, Stitcher.com, and Audio Boo. Greetings, ladies and gentlemen. My name's Christian Corley. I'm the editor of Castorbis.com. With me is James McLean and Brian Turnover. How are you doing, fellas?
Very good. It's Monday. Who doesn't love a Monday?
I love Mondays.
Actually, I don't mind Mondays.
I love Mondays. Ever since round about 1985, on ITV at 4:20, He-Man and the Masters of the Universe was always on a Monday. So I celebrate Mondays for that reason ever since.
Ever since? 30 years of Monday celebration with James McLean and He-Man.
Yeah.
Okay.
Get your Beastman on.
Okay. Get your Beastman on indeed. Now, it's James, Brian and myself, and we have one other special guest today as well. Here to promote his new movie out in December. It's Chewbacca! That's pretty much it. Unfortunately, none of us speak Wookiee, so we won't really be able to ask him any questions that we'll then be able to discern a reply from.
I'm semi-fluent.
No, you're semi-fluent in Wookiee. Well, that's good.
Well, I was at school. It was a choice between that or French.
It's always the way, isn't it?
Seeing the way that pop culture was moving in the late 80s, I had a feeling that Wookiee would probably have a longer benefit to me to learn, certainly by 2015.
Well, shall we ask him a question and then you can translate?
Yeah.
Okay, go on. Chewbacca, we're really looking forward to seeing the new Star Wars film. How excited by it are you?
Ah, 16 inches. See, so while I speak quite a good Wookiee, he's not very good with English.
Yeah, okay. So, moving on. We're going to talk about misconceptions, strangely enough, following that. It's almost as if we scripted that. imagine the thought. In this week's Castorbis podcast with the K, we're going to discuss Doctor Who misconceptions. People, things, stories that have been wrong about Doctor Who, whether they're like little stories that you've heard other people tell you or things that you've read in the press that have got it completely wrong, or just things that you've had that you've misconceived over Doctor Who, maybe in your kind of little headcanon or some other thing that goes on. It was Brian's very clever suggestion to this. I don't know, how do you want to start? Does anyone want to go first, or shall we have a look? That one I just mentioned to give the... I'll tell you what, we'll give the listener, hello listener, by the way, an example. So this is from a Reddit thread, which very usefully exists for us to fall back on, even though it's completely unrelated to the formation or conception of this feature. Just wanted to put that in there. For instance, someone said, my first episode was Rose back in 2005. I don't know why, but I was under the impression that both the Doctor and the companion regenerated. I thought the plot of that episode would be the new Doctor finding the new Rose after being separated somehow. I watched the whole thing, thinking that twist was coming. So, and it seems that this isn't a rare thing, because someone replied saying, haha, nice, I also believe the companion regenerated, and was thus confused when I discovered all these companions not named Clara. So there you go.
That's fair enough.
Yeah. So, Brian.
Yeah.
You pushed us in this direction, so I was willingly we went along with him. I'm not saying that he's kind of dictatorial.
No, I twisted your arm. It's okay. Go on. You can tell the truth.
Okay. So, so what did you have in mind when we started this? Did you have one in particular?
Well, you know, there's just some, one obvious one, you know, to get some of them out of the way is, and in fairness, some people can be forgiven for this since the show seems to forget it as well. But one of the hugest ones is that the Doctor is simply named the Doctor, not Doctor Who. and which some people, you know, they get confused by that because in the credits, he's listed either or, depending on which actor is playing the role or who put the credits together that day. You have Wotan, who was calling the Doctor, Doctor Who. But I do see a lot of people. It's weird because, like, I don't necessarily see fans often referring to him as Doctor Who, although occasionally you do. Whereas more often it's the people in the media and so on that will just say, and of course we've got the current Doctor Who here, you know, and it makes me wonder why all this time that is still so commonly held or rather still common of a misconception that people still have. You'd think some people would actually do the homework in the media to correct themselves when they're getting an actor to from the show to actually speak with them, which of course David Tennant has done. And I know, I think Peter Capaldi has done, but I certainly know that somebody has done so in his steed. Craig Ferguson, that's who it was. But go on, sorry.
Okay, well, I think either or all three of the first Doctors called the character Doctor Who off stage, off camera, in interviews and things like that. And obviously he was listed as Doctor Who all the way up until 1980, 81. Right. So, I mean, there's a kind of large precedent for calling him Doctor Who.
Yeah, but on screen, he's never been called Doctor Who outside a couple of handful of choices, like Wotan from the
War Machines,
thank you, which I brought up. And I can't remember some of the other ones, but I do remember that there was, I think, at least one or two other times that it was mentioned in the show. And then, of course, you have the 60s movie with Peter Cushing where that is his actual name, even though the origin of that character is so vastly different, you can't claim it's the same person. But yeah, no, I get that, and I do think that, like what you said, the early actors used to speak of the character in that way, and I think that's obviously definitely where the misconceptions come from. But remember when David Tennant took the role, the credits for Christopher Eccleston said Doctor Who.
Doctor Who, yeah.
And when he took the role, he had them correct it to the Doctor. Which I thought was nice and helpful of him to do this way. Like, people would see that and see like that his character is simply the Doctor, and it was a helpful way. And it was like one of those little fan things that he saw was a big misconception that he wanted to try and correct in some way.
But at the same time, it's a bit daft because you have in the credits, you have someone called Bus Driver. You don't think his first name's Bus.
Yes.
And, you know, exactly. He's Betty Driver's his wife and you know, his son, Arnie Driver. You know, it's credits aren't. I know. I totally agree with what your point being the sort of diegetic thing that he is the Doctor, not Doctor Who, but people call him that. But at the same time, in fairness, the credits were just doing what that was established who he was as a conception of the show in the same way that
And you've got old scripts as well that listed the characters Doctor Who. So you know the writers were as guilty as everyone else.
Yeah, but again, those are the things, like, it doesn't make it on screen. Yeah, he may have been scripted as Doctor Who, but if it didn't make it on screen, those scripts don't really matter. You know, it's just like when something happens, there's a character twist or a character development, a piece of information that, you know, we should have known about a character, but it didn't make it into the final cut.
Okay, well, listen, I know a girl called Charlotte Green. She's not called that anymore because she got married. And she's not the Charlotte Green off the telly. She's a different Charlotte Green. Just wanted to clarify that. And a few years ago, we spent a lot of time together over a short period, and we were talking about Doctor Who on one occasion. And she was under the impression this will have been 96 sort of time. So this will have been I'll have been excited about the Paul McGann thing basically, and she was under the impression that the Daleks were in every single episode of Doctor Who because of the Doctor Who and the Daleks sort of meme. I'd managed to talk her into watching one, which may have been, if it wasn't the Paul McGann one, because I don't think that yet come out, it may have been Pyramid of Mars, because that was always a favourite in those days. And she's absolutely baffled by it because there's no Daleks in it. I'm not entirely sure how the addition of Daleks into the Pyramid of Mars would have made it any less baffling. I think it would have been even more baffling, wouldn't it, if you'd have thrown the Daleks in there as well. So that was... And apparently she wasn't alone in this. There was a lot of people who thought that the Daleks were in every episode of Doctor Who. where you get, I suppose things like, you know, Sidemen, Sontarans and Master were just completely not on these people's radars.
Well, you know, I mean, that's interesting, because one of the things that I guess we have to consider with a lot of these misconceptions is how many of the fans out there that watch the show religiously, but still believe, like, an odd fact, they still have a misconception about some kind of a common fact, when they should have, by this point, have had it corrected for them at some point, versus a casual viewer who, what do they know from the show? They know the scarf, they know the box, and they know the Daleks. You know, they might not even know about regeneration, really. So it's kind of like a fair point for someone who's a casual viewer to kind of believe, especially if you kind of grew up in the 60s when Dalek episodes happen so often, and even now that Dalek episodes happen at least once a season, if not twice. So yeah, it's in a sense, it's a forgivable misconception if it's a peripheral show for you.
Mm.
I would say, that's kind of really, I mean, like, this isn't, I guess we should say, this show isn't really to point out that people have things wrong, what the hell are you thinking kind of thing. This is just, these are kind of curious misconceptions and maybe why they are conceived the way that they are. Because it is, like, some of them are very curious to me, like, outside of that one, like I said, which, certainly a casual viewer, I could totally get that. But if you were a long-time viewer, no one's really going to think that, obviously, because they know. So it's a casual kind of perception of the show, and I get that. It's interesting. But one of these other ones, we're looking at we found a couple misconceptions that people had online that we found interesting, and we were going to use some of them as examples. Christian already used one in the beginning. But one of them is that someone just thought that the different actors – there was no regeneration. They just hired a new actor to play the same role, and they were really kind of shocked. They thought Colin Baker had a physical similarity to Tom Baker. Mm. But then when they saw Sylvester McCoy, they were very shocked at how different he was, because they thought they were just trying to replace one actor with a similar-looking actor. And I have to say, when I was a kid, and I'm talking like back when I was like 9 or 10 now, when I first was watching the show, I remembered seeing a Tom Baker episode or a couple Tom Baker episodes in a row, and then all of a sudden there was Peter Davison, and my misconception was pretty much the same thing. They just replaced the lead actor. There was no explanation, because I didn't see a regeneration story, so I didn't know about regeneration. But unlike this person, I was so confused as to why they would get somebody so vastly different rather than somebody similar to try and make the change of actor less noticeable, you know? So it's silly. I mean, like, you know, a lot of these misconceptions can come from somebody just being new to the show or a casual viewer to the show. And yet we still have some for people who are long-term.
I'm going to throw some in, I think, for fans. We're not just mocking people who've actually got a life and don't spend all their time focusing on Doctor Who, but we're mocking people who don't have a life and spend all their time focusing on Doctor Who. So here's one I always like, is the Valiard. The misconception that the Valiard is meant to have been his last regeneration.
Oh, yeah.
You get that a lot, especially in forums. So, yeah. And that obviously caused a lot of upset with Capaldi. I mean, again, not being a fan without a life, I'm not sure if I remember rightly, but as I recall, he says that he's a vestige, but somewhere between
his 12th and final. The word 13 is never mentioned. So
yeah,
people have equated final to 13 from the dialogue. And assumed that the last Doctor would be the Valiard, as opposed to a distillation. I think distillation is what the Master uses.
I think distillation is used, yes.
Yeah.
So there's one. And that obviously makes... That's obviously quite a trumped-up fan often comes up with that. So that's one. Yeah. The other one I think is a little more interesting, which comes more from... I don't think it's ever been... I think it has been alluded to in the show, and it is something which is more of a argument rather than a certain fact. But the idea that the TARDIS is infinite...
Right.
Which I was getting, well, I mean, the most obvious thing is that if you jettison 25% of infinity, you don't jettison 25%. So you obviously got that, but if you'd be tying that down to a couple of stories. But I always got the impression that it was a sort of infinite dimension, because the TARDIS has a finite power, since it loses power in various episodes. You could argue there's a finite resources within an infinite space. But the idea that the TARDIS just goes on forever and ever and ever, which I used to think as a kid, I think is, given what you see in the show, is a misconception.
Mm. I think in William the New Adventures, they kind of took advantage of that, didn't they, and made it as big or as small as the story demanded. And I think there's...
Yeah.
I don't think there's anything wrong with that, but I think you've got to be careful with that, because if it's infinite, then why would you leave it?
Exactly.
You know, if you've got a swimming pool, if you've got like a sort of half a planet in there, you wouldn't bother going outside, would you?
I mean, I could imagine, I think in one of them, it sort of becomes the size of a planet, which is... Hmm. I could imagine you could do, but I'd imagine you would really stretch the resources. I mean, I think it's important the TARDIS isn't infinite, because as soon as it is infinite, it has infinite possibilities.
Yeah.
So, well, and but yeah, as a kid, would I even be...
What's that?
Why? So I was going to say, the other question for me would be, why would it be infinite? Why would you create something like that?
Exactly. That was exactly my point. I was going to say, why would they do that? Because what we know about the Time Lords is that they govern over time. You know, they don't intervene in time except for those few instances when they send the Doctor in to do their dirty work for them. But the whole point was that they were supposed to just be watching it and making sure time unfolded as they had recorded it. You know, and so they build these machines supposedly so they can go anywhere and just see time happen. But presumably you're not living there for millennia. Why would you need an infinite space? You know, it doesn't make any sense. All you really need is a vehicle, kind of like a car, to get you where you're going. And you could blend in with your surroundings, so you're unnoticed. You know, you don't really need it that gigantic.
I quite like the idea, the further out or in, however you want to call it, to the TARDIS area, that you would perhaps see time would become less stable. So you could end up in loops and areas which loop round, or possibly even an infinite recursion sort of thing. But that's not the same as having an infinite space. That's one thing I do like about Doctor Who is that the whole idea that came up later, that they were sort of a benign overseer of the universe. TARDIS has really made sense, didn't they? The way they could blend into the background.
Yeah.
Because you could land in a time zone as a tree and just not come out and just scan everything as a tree and then go again, which wasn't the original idea, but it just fitted very well with that idea.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Okay.
The only other ones, I was just going to throw one more out, which wasn't particularly, it was one I had as a kid. I didn't know it, but it was something which really used to frustrate me, was having not seen many of the Pertwee ones. At first, it confused me how I'd see photos of a console in a room without the roundels all around it. And it got to a point where it actually get quite upsetting for me. And it was the same for Bessie as well, because I hadn't seen so many. I wondered how he got Bessie out of the TARDIS. As well as how he pulled the console out of the TARDIS, because of the size of the doors, just didn't marry for me. So I suppose, yeah, if I think really, when I was really young, I used to think Bessie would somehow be stored in the TARDIS, and used to spend moments between episodes of He-Man wondering how Bessie would get in and out of those double doors.
Okay, there's a good one here, which I like, because you can see how this misconception is created, because it makes perfect sense in its own context. Before 2008, I thought it was a British show about a man in a scarf named Doctor Who, whose entrance to his secret base was in a blue phone box. Mm. You can totally see how someone would think that.
Yeah.
Now, I've got one of my own as well, which I'd forgotten to mention earlier. And around the same sort of He-Man on a Monday watching period, actually, as well, this comes from, which is... having seen the Five Doctors and the Two Doctors and knowing about regeneration, I had this thing in my head of how the Doctor could regenerate and yet still have subsequent adventures that you hadn't already seen. And that was that when he regenerates, another Doctor comes in and the old Doctor goes away and carries on having adventures elsewhere, which obviously makes complete utter nonsense, but that's how I worked it out in my 9-year-old head, so that other Doctor could then come back and have adventures later on, not obviously completely ignoring the linear impossibility of that.
I think I remember having something a bit like that in my head.
Really?
I remember there was my brain somehow sort of decided, it's locked onto a course that it was how things like the Three Doctors and the Five Doctors could work. Is that those Doctors would somehow still perpetuate in their own timeline, which again, as you say, makes no linear sense whatsoever. But it sort of, in my head, explained how the Doctor could be walking in a rose garden in the Five Doctors, or how Troughton could meet Pertwee on, you know, it just that they weren't within their time zones, that they carried on after somehow.
Yeah, yeah, that's exactly how I'd worked it out as well, yeah. How strange.
It's weird.
Yeah.
It's an interesting concept. It would be a fun thing to see them explore, although it's not an easy thing to convey to people, which in a sense is actually great, because they're aliens, and not being able to fully understand it is to me kind of a perfect thing for aliens, because rather than put it in terms that we as humans can understand, there's some creatures, some beings out there that have a higher understanding than us that, you know, we just can't fathom. So because they can do it means they can do it. We just can't understand how they can do it. I think, well, I don't think there's anything wrong with that in this case. I think that'd be kind of neat.
You could imagine it almost if you think of time as being something far more flexible for them, but something that they live in. You could almost imagine it like a shedding of a skin, that they shed a skin to a new timeline, and the old timeline carries on, but there's new timelines being broken out. A bit like the end of The Five Doctors, the way the police box splits into five when it leaves, because it's three actually, because Baker isn't there, into three different, as they head off, it's sort of almost like the timeline breaks off into the strands it needs to do for that one object. And that's, I suppose, how you'd imagine it. So William Hartnell would change into Troughton and then get up, and he'd still be William Hartnell, but he'd have generated a new timeline where William Hartnell, his time energy had now created a new one of him, almost like reproduction, multiplied a new timeline with a new doctor who was born for a new world. And it would become almost like a reproduction cycle.
Right. Do you know what this reminds me of? Do you know what this reminds me of? Interference.
What, the book?
Yeah.
I've read it, and I'm trying to remember it.
This is the one with the Foreman character.
I am Foreman, who lives... Yeah, but he...
Who's like 12 Time Lords.
Yes.
All existing at the same time, but the same Time Lord.
Yeah.
I wonder if that's where Lawrence Miles got the idea from. Maybe he had it as well. Maybe he was thinking about it in that line and extrapolated it to create Iron Foreman.
I think it's a nice idea in the sense that it totally creates... It's not nice for audiences, because audiences like...
It's ultimately confusing, isn't it? Yeah.
Well, it's audiences like linear relationships that mirror their own understandings, their own life. It's why Doctor Who fans get so angry when continuity doesn't work anymore in a show which is about time changing, because they want to see a linear progression, and they don't like the idea of, you know, Sarah Jane dying in the books and then the Time War and then Sarah Jane reliving again and not remembering any of those adventures. I mean, that's how you'd probably plot it if you were taking all the extended media in. Mm. But people don't like that. They like things to be solid and certain. So they don't like the idea of, you know, almost like a Time Lord line of it almost being regenerations being a reproduction of pregnancy before you generate a new timeline with a new doctor and you've had your pregnancy and you carry on. That would be the sort of interesting way of doing it. But people get upset with that. People got upset with the Valiard, really, in the same sort of way. It disrupted their linear belief that there's sort of this distillation. How does that work?
Well, I think obviously the thing about the Valiard is that he's kind of, I mean, he's redundant, isn't he? Although he's not in that story, but the presence of the Master makes the Master redundant, because you've basically got two Masters.
Yeah.
Although, then again, you've got two Masters in Mark of the Rani in some ways, haven't you?
Yeah. Yeah, I know. It's. I think the problem with the Valiard was they couldn't find a better agenda for him. I think the only way they could have done it would have been to somehow make him more of a sympathetic villain, in the sense that he was the Doctor, more like the John Hurt one, I think, but more malevolent than John Hurt's, but a distillation which the audience could almost sympathise with, but be worried about and fear.
You know, I see what you're saying with the Valiard. I completely agree with that, but I don't see how the Rani was kind of like the Master and the Mark of the Rani. I've always found them to be very separate. Like, the Master is always out trying to gain himself more power, essentially, and rule the universe, where the Rani just always seemed like she was in for the science to me.
I know. Well,
you know?
She's ultimately the totally neutral, isn't she? She's immoral. She's an immoral character rather than an evil. But in the sense of within the story, you've got two very similar antagonists, two evil Time Lords to the audience, both of them for the Doctor to fight, both of them have a TARDIS, both of them use kill people. There's a lot of tropes which sit between the two. I totally agree with you. The nuances make them very different.
Yeah,
but the same with the Valiant.
I actually like the fact that they even try to use each other. You know, I mean, I rather than like, rather than doing the stereotypical thing of you have these two bad guys that are both like, hey, you know, we want this Doctor out of the way, why don't we just gang up together? They essentially kind of do, but at the same time, they're trying to use each other and they just kind of want each other out of their own hair. I don't know. I mean, I see what you're saying and it's there and I agree, but it's kind of tough. If you're going to keep bringing in evil Time Lords, you're always going to have that. So, I mean, the idea of never bringing them together probably should be the first thought on the table.
Well, I think your argument would be that it's not that you don't bring them together, but retrospectively, to have the Rani introduced on her own to establish her, and then you could do a team up later.
Yeah.
But I think probably Mark the Rani. Because it weakens them. I mean, I know what you mean, and I totally agree with everything you're saying. The problem with Mark the Rani, though, is that the Master is weakened by the Rani, who seems a stronger character, and he seems a bit of an idiot.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
With the Valyard, though, I thought, obviously we'll get back to misconceptions here, but I thought it would have been neat rather than him, you know, wanting to kill the Doctor and basically have the same kind of thoughts as the Master. I think it would have been interesting if the way that he snapped was not so much he wanted power, but more so he wanted to go back and fix all the things that he did wrong, all the things that he didn't do because there were laws of time. You know, he maybe wanted to instead go out and stop evil, but not be restrained by the laws of time or anything like that. It would have been more like he was a bit more of a haphazard Doctor, one who didn't care about the rules, regulations, or the effects on the universe, just so long as he could save that one little life. It would have been interesting because you still would have had him being the Doctor at heart, which is wanting to help and save people, but he would have been a much more terminal type version of him, which would have set him apart. And I think that is definitely where the Valyard falls flat on his face, is that he was a little too Master, especially with the way that he just wanted to kill the Doctor the whole time. And it was, you know, people always want to see him come back, and I'm kind of always like, meh, not really, just because of that fact. If they had done something more interesting, then it would have been quite a good thing to see him return.
I always think it'd been quite good if they took, because I mean, what you're saying is quite interesting, because in a way you could argue that where you're positioning the Valyard isn't that far from Water of Mars and Tennant, or
sure, exactly,
even to a degree what Capaldi says in the very first episode of In Deep Breath, which doesn't follow through, almost as if he wants to make up for the things he's done wrong. But to actually have an old Doctor for a whole series arc who he actually plays as the nemesis, and how you do that, I don't know, there'd be loads of ways of doing it. I mean, it could even just be simply you get a Doctor who is particularly different. You can get around the age factors, I'm sure, within the story, but have someone like Colin Baker or Sylvester McCoy as someone who challenges the role for some reason. I know it sounds a vague idea, but to actually have a Doctor you could sympathise with, the audience would automatically sympathise with because they've seen the Doctor before, and yet position them in an adverse but not evil situation could be a very interesting way to run a three-part story, if not a series. And do the sort of Valyard, but actually make the audience like the antagonist, or and perhaps even want the antagonist than just this simple binary thing of, you know, evil Doctor and good Doctor, which is what the Valyard was doing, and he didn't even act like the Doctor, so that was the other problem. I know.
Yeah. You know, a great way to do that too would be to take stories from the past of Doctor Who, and let's say like. I don't know. Let's take a huge example that fans still are upset about to this day. We'll take two. We'll take Rose being stuck in the alternate universe and Donna having, you know, no other recourse but to have her memories stripped from her. And you would take that Valyard character and you would make them go back, and they're hell bent on either retrieving Rose from that universe and resuming their life together, or restoring Donna's life back to what it was, you know. And this way the audience can sympathize completely with that character, because you're making that character do something they've been screaming for forever. And that would be a great way to get them to see, like, this guy's not really a bad guy. He wants what you want, but we need to see it now from the Doctor's perspective of why that is a bad thing, kind of. situation.
Well, you could set that after Waters of Mars.
Well, you could, they did with Day of the Doctor, and you have Tom Baker appear as a future potential doctor using an old form. So you could actually pick any of the living doctors and actually have them as a future vestige, even as the Valiard, if you wanted to, specifically, or just a future vestige, which has come back and is fixated with an old mistake that the doctor's got to fight them for. I mean, going back to Sylvester McCoy, you've got perhaps the destruction of Skyro, where that led. I mean, that was quite a massive act, wasn't it, in Remembrance of the Daleks?
Mm-hmm.
Colin Baker, he might be coming back to take vengeance on a script writer.
on Michael Grade.
Tom Baker, Lalla Ward, I don't know, Adric. You know, I'm sure there's many targets who the Fourth Doctor would probably like to. No, I don't know. But something like that could be interesting. Or, you know, saying Lalla Ward. You know, someone like Lalla Ward or even Matthew Waterhouse. Yeah, these are characters which have positions in history which you could actually bring back as an adversary. I mean, comics have done it all the time. Jason Todd with Robin, you know, Adric. Bitter Adric is one, or, you know, a Romana who has just lost her way.
I'll ask this of you two, I guess. We've talked about how it would be more interesting for the Valiard to have those kind of goals. Do you think that it's still a viable option if they brought him back today and kind of retroactively made that have been his goal all along, but in the first place, he was maybe trying to dispatch with the Doctor because he was disgusted with who he was and wants to move on with this. But if we bring him back, essentially see part two to the Valiard story and we see what his goals actually are, do you think still work as an afterthought now, or do you think it would have been better just to do it from the beginning and forget it now?
If I was to do it, I would make it an amalgamate thing. I like the idea of it perhaps being something which doesn't have maybe even a particular form. Not for this sort of fan wank idea of bringing Adric back or the Romana back, but it would be quite nice to have an embodiment of the regret of the Doctor from the future. Which they could even at one point say sometimes he's known as the Valiard without actually intrinsically linking it to a sort of fairly duff story, 1986, and actually avoid doing that. You throw in the nice little reference, but do something different. That could be quite fun. You could have some interesting cameos as well if those faces that comes back through this amalgamate, this distillation, are faces that audiences might know. And yeah, I mean, the guy, I can't remember, what Michael, what was the name of the actor who played him?
Michael Jaston,
yeah. He could come back as well as one of those faces. So you could really link him to the Valiard and say to people who know him from the past, this is the Valiard, without getting caught into sort of trying to say, yes, he's a sort of nemesis that I've met in the past who tried to take, you know, and just ignore all that and just have him as a new villain with a slight historical associationship who could do all these things. I mean, he could basically go through this Reddit list and, I don't know, be trying to sort out some of these misconceptions.
Speaking of misconceptions, to get things back on to misconceptions.
It was a poor segue, go on.
Hey. But you know what? It worked. It's working as long as I can get my thought out. There is a character within Doctor Who that also had a misconception that it seems fans have picked up on and held that misconception for a while. Who knows how long, but some of them had that. And I think, honestly, they can be forgiven for this one. And that character was Clive from the episode Rose. When he told Rose his conspiracy theory about the Doctor, and he said that I think the name is passed down, the Doctor is passed down from either father to son or so on and so forth. And a lot of fans had picked up on that, and for a while they actually thought that that's what it was. You know, they didn't really know about regeneration. And these are a lot of fans who maybe kind of stepped in during Smith's era and went back to watch the beginning and maybe hadn't seen a regeneration episode yet, you know, or even started in Capaldi's era, etc. And the reason why I think it can actually be forgiven is because take a look at what Rose did. It hit us with a lot of continuity, a lot of things that we needed to know about basically the format of the show, the concept of the show and the characters. And to have that one piece of information, if you stepped into this show knowing that it was a revival of a TV show, a previous TV show rather, that you might be seeing that information as information that you need to hold on to rather than incorrect information. It might be, you know, you learn what the TARDIS is, you learn who the doctor is, you learn what he's doing out there and so on. But, and here you go, you get this other little fact. Oh, well, that probably explains all those other actors I looked up on the internet. You know, it seemed an interesting thing that, you know, a misconception happened for a character within the show, but people also adopted it as well, just because it to me, it holds weight, I think. Believability, anyway. Plausibility, maybe.
Plausibility, yeah. Okay. Well, so that's there's some good misconceptions here, and I think we should probably hand it over to the listener to give us some of their misconceptions from this point onwards, because I don't think of any. I don't think I've got any others. I can't recall any others that worth mentioning anyway.
Okay, I've got one more. I think I'll just
go on
then.
And that's the Peter Cushing, which I think is mentioned in the Reddit, but I remember when I was young and seeing again, because we only had pretty much the Peter Hayning book, if we ever had that, and seeing the Peter Cushing and thinking somehow that had some continuity fix.
Oh, I never thought that.
Sent back to Earth. Yeah. I think I must have read that before knowing that was John Pertwee, and wondering if that bit, you know, seeing photos of him and having seen the film, actually, thinking maybe that's when he was sent back to Earth. And,
you know, I never thought that it was in any way related. I just always assumed because it was a film, it was just a film version. That's interesting.
Oh, yeah.
Wasn't until I was like sort of 13 or 14 that I was aware that they were adaptations of TV episodes, though.
No, well, that's it. I think I must have seen one of the films. I think I've seen the first film. And then read in a book where there was very few pictures saying the Doctor was exiled back to Earth, and thinking that must have been the link. But yeah, there we go.
Yes.
What was yours, Brian?
Go on, Brian.
Mine is it's one that people still debate to this day, really, and it's something I personally think falls under a misconception, and that is the Eye of Harmony being in the TARDIS in the TV.
Oh yeah, yeah.
And the reason I say that is because a lot of people harp on that fact. Now, granted, it's no secret that story really borrowed quite heavily from the Deadly Assassin in its plot line. But the fact that a lot of people want to complain that the Eye of Harmony is in the TARDIS when it was previously on Gallifrey is something that I always just found a little silly to me, because to me it is a misconception in the respect that before they ever showed us what a sonic screwdriver was in the show, we had no idea what a sonic screwdriver was until the Doctor showed us that he had one.
Yeah, yeah.
So for them to say that there's an Eye of Harmony within the TARDIS, why people want to complain that it's there, when, rather than going, okay, well, I guess there's a part of the Eye of Harmony in every TARDIS, that's how they run, because it's just new information to us. You know, to me, I never looked at that and went, hey, that doesn't make any sense. But so many people do. Just like any other new piece of information we get within the show, I think we have to process it accordingly. And I think, personally, it falls under a massive misconception rather than somebody taking it as new information.
Well, it ties in with Trial of a Time Lord as well, because we know that the Time Lords can track the TARDIS. And how else better to track the TARDIS through working out where it's going through its power source that is directly linked to the main Time Lord power source,
which
we know is a black hole, so it's therefore infinite. So it makes no sense for it to be a misconception. I agree with totally what you're saying, Brian, that anyone should think that's incorrect in some way, because it makes perfect sense.
To be fair, I mean, I know what you mean. I mean, you could almost see it like, you know, if the TARDISes are all linked together like a superhighway of internetdom, the Eye of Harmony is almost like the access point, the router to the Eye of Harmony. It's the portal that links it to the actual source. But at the same time, it seemed quite clear to me watching it that there was to pitch it simply to American audiences, there was a lot of science fiction archetypes, common ones at the time, which were being used. And let's face it, the Eye of Harmony was being used like the warp drive of the Enterprise. It was the engine, and it was sort of kept very ambiguous, but simply, that was pretty much what it was. It was in the same way, you know, you had to push that he was half human and the cloaking device.
Sure. I'm not even arguing that it wasn't being used as the engine. I'm just saying that, like, the Eye of Harmony is on Gallifrey. That is their power source, and that is exactly how they talked about it. It powers everything they have. Well, you know, rather than taking your car to the gas station, maybe there's this little chunk of the Eye of Harmony or a link, kind of like how two computers can be linked together via Wi-Fi. You know, there's no wires, there's no actual hookups. These two things are just hooked that way, and maybe that's a little piece of the Eye of Harmony. And I get that in the script, they never thought that this was a link. I totally understand that, and I'm not trying to say that, you know, for sure that's what it is. It's just that what I'm saying is we're always given new information in the show. Sometimes those things don't make sense, and it's a lot easier to go, hey, it does make sense if we just put it this way. Why are we getting so bent out of shape about this thing that actually can work? It has, I mean, we don't know what really powers the TARDIS, so why not that? The
Eye of Harmony. And also, that theory also, it also helps the TV movie Master being the Deadly Assassin Master as well.
Sure. Okay, yeah, I see where you're going with that.
Because he falls through the Eye of Harmony, ends up in Gallifrey, meets up with Chancellor Goth and all that, moves on from there. And then, obviously, at some point, he dies after pinching Dreamrass's body and then gets resurrected for the Time War.
And plus, the whole joke of it is the TARDIS is a transcendental thing which exists in two places at the same time. So why the hell the Eye of Harmony can't exist in every TARDIS and on Gallifrey at the same time as well is another point. Is even if you want to go down the idea that it is the Eye of Harmony, then it would be the Eye of Harmony, which is a singularity point which exists in all those features because it's transcendental.
Oh, that's a very good point, because it is a collapsed star. They talked about that. So it totally might not even exist on Gallifrey. It could be somewhere out there in the universe, and it's all in those same places. Kind of like how the Doctor described the TARDIS to Leela. You know, he said, if you take that one box and you keep it there, yet you still have it over here, one can exist inside the other. That would explain perfectly how the Eye of Harmony could work.
Yeah. Mm.
Interesting. Mm.
Interesting. Okay, then. So, dear listener, we're handing it over to you. Give us your misconceptions, whether ones you've had or ones that you've heard, and do share them in the comments or tweet us, or you could even record your own thing for Audio Boom if you really wanted to. You don't have to, but you could. And then we'll be able to listen to you telling us, which would be a bit weird because it would be like us tuning into a podcast in reply to the podcast. That's a bit too scary, actually. Yes. Anyway, so recommendations time. It is now. And do you know what I've done? I had a look through my DVD collection a couple of days ago, wanting to watch The Demons, and I realised that I don't have it on DVD. So I've ordered The Demons on DVD. I know! I think I possibly had I definitely did have a review copy, which is why I've got confused, but I gave the review copy away to someone to review.
Aha.
So,
we'll forgive you then.
Thanks. So, I've got that coming in a couple of days. I'm going to, do you know what? I'm going to go first with, because I've had the benefit of watching Resurrection of the Daleks with 4-year-old eyes today, of this week, I should say. I've just switched from Virgin Media to a FreeSat box, which is basically that's a satellite box that you get satellite TV through, but it's not Sky's satellite TV, it's terrestrial channels mostly, which saved me a lot of money, basically. So I've gone to FreeSat, and I've discovered that, unlike on main Sky and on Virgin Media without an extended package, you get the horror channel. So Bruce and Erin Rose and I watched Resurrection of the Daleks on Sunday morning. I'll say... We watched the first episode until the advert break, and it was then that Erin Rose decided that she really didn't like it. It was far too scary for her. Melted faces on the prison ship. Bruce was enjoying
it. My sister went crazy over that.
Yeah, I'm not surprised. Bruce was enjoying it, but he was getting a bit concerned about Erin Rose, so he decided that we shouldn't watch anymore, but we'll watch it another day when it's just me and him. It was strange watching it in that way, because it is kind of, it's an Eric Soward piece, isn't it? So it's not entirely a surprise, but it is kind of a bit gritty and a bit humorless, isn't it?
Very.
Yeah.
I remember, as I say, my sister was really young, and she came and I came back, or she came back from somewhere. I mean, she was, we were talking about, God, about four or five, she was. And she came in just when the guy turns round. And it's not the fact he's got the burned face. It's a very rare circumstance in television where you can see he is, he's aware of it. He's aware that something horrible is happening to him. And he's appealing for help. Which I think is a horribly dark concept for a family show. And it freaked her out for years.
Yeah, I'm not surprised.
I don't know. It just that one singular thing. So yeah, and it's not just that. I mean, virtually everyone dies in it by the end, which is the whole point for Tegan to leave.
Yeah.
So there's no happiness in it at all. I mean, the only comedy you've got is the wonderful is that wonderful line. Yeah, you know which one I mean. I can't.
Someone
going to
say, yeah, go on. In my mind.
In my mind, it's worth it just for that. But that's it. I mean, the rest of it. The only good thing I do like about, I like it actually personally. But one thing I like about it is the fact that Turlough plays very close to who he is in it, where he is actually very much just a coward. Well, not even just a coward, just a person who just doesn't want to be there.
Yeah,
and just wants to get out. There's very little heroism from him, which just seems to be very much what he should be.
Which is not much of an adventure for him either, is it? Because he spends most of the time on the Dalek ship.
Yeah.
So he doesn't get the chance to go out and do anything. So he's bound to kind of revert into that kind of.
Well, he starts on the Earth ship, and and then slips onto the Dalek ship later. But yeah, no, it's an interesting. Yes, it's an interesting one to show your small kids.
Yeah, so if you do have 4-year-olds, probably not a good idea to show them Resurrection of the Daleks. Just, yeah, maybe wait until they're a little bit older. I mean, how old was it? When was it? 1984, Resurrection of the Daleks. So I will have been just gone 8. So that's probably a good time for a Resurrection of the Daleks. At a guess. There are fluffier ones you can show small children. Dinosaurs on a spaceship. Comedy robots and dinosaurs, they go down well. But it's one of those ones that doesn't really work on multiple levels for young children, Resurrection of the Daleks. So,
slow.
Yeah,
it's nasty.
Lesson learned there. Okay, who else has got recommendation?
I've got one. I haven't been watching anything new, but I'm bringing this up because the other day, about, I don't know, 2-3 days ago, Fox released a trailer for the upcoming X-Files revival for next year. And it's a light trailer. I mean, they've only finished filming 2 episodes, so you can't expect much. Yet it's still an extremely enticing trailer. I mean, I can't tell you how many times I've watched this thing already because I'm so excited. But the reason I bring it up is because I'm on a lot of like X-Files forums and so on out there reading everybody's thoughts. And there are a lot of newcomers to the show who are asking, you know, can I just watch the mythology episodes? Because for those of you who may not know, the X-Files, rather than having one full-on running arc throughout all 9 of its original years of the show, it would do its mythology in random episodes throughout the season, making up maybe, you know, 5, 6, 7 episodes per season, depending on the season, out of usually up to 22 to 25 episodes. And the rest were Monster of the Week stories, individual cases of the paranormal that weren't connected to the main kind of mythology. And a lot of people answer these things, you know, in various responses, saying, yes, you can, no, you can't, or yeah, but try this as well. And my first school of thought on that is that I wanted to throw out there, especially going through my own rewatch of the show, is do watch them all. And the reason I say that is because you get so much character development in the Monster of the Week stories, not to say that you don't get that in the mythology stories, but there's a lot of things that happen in those Monster of the Week stories that I would argue that the mythology of the show does cross into all of the stories. If you want to say that the mythology being their actual personal lives, their full story, you're going to miss a lot if you don't watch all those episodes specifically connecting to the mythology. The one example I can give without spoiling it for those who haven't seen it, there's a storyline for Scully during season 4. And if you watch only the mythology episodes, you miss 2 very beautiful moments for her personal story that happen in Monster of the Week stories connected to this thing, which has deep roots within the mythology itself. So saying that, the new series, 6 episodes, bookended with mythology stories. The middle stories are going to be Monster of the Week stories, which supposedly have connections to the rest. To give you an idea, that's how the show is going to be when it comes back. So you might as well watch it from the beginning on and catch it how it was in the past if it's going to be exactly the same way when it comes back. So I wanted to hopefully belay some confusion for people out there not knowing where to start just by saying if you watch it all, you get the fullest picture and the most fulfilling enjoyment of that show. So that's
Can
my
I just
recommendation,
add
watch
to
it
that.
In whole.
I just want to add to that excellent recommendation. I say if you're interested in watching it, then go back to the beginning and watch it. Otherwise, just catch up later on after it's happened. I watched, with Kerry, my wife, watched four series of Game of Thrones in sort of a month and a half to 2 months before series five of Game of Thrones. You've got a year until The X-Files is on. So you've plenty of time to catch up.
Oh, yeah.
And watch every episode.
And Netflix has it all the seasons right now. They're up to, I think, season six in the new HD widescreen transfers. But Amazon Prime also has it full HD widescreen as well. And I think Hulu does as well. So plenty of places to find it online. You don't have to go track down DVDs.
I like Amazon Prime. I especially like that big blue and red truck he turns into. James, your recommendation?
I recommend you... don't watch the X-Files, but you go and get some box sets of Millennium, the sister show out. We've been recently been pushing to get that onto Netflix. So go and watch that.
How's that going?
Well, you know, there's interesting things going on behind the scenes at the moment, which I can't talk about.
Fine.
Sorry.
No. I mean, fine. Don't tell us. No. That is fine. Not like, fine. Be like that. No, I mean, that's
I know,
fine.
It sounded a bit
Do
like
carry
that.
On.
Fine.
Didn't mean to.
But yeah, no. I mean, I wasn't particularly bothered about it being on Netflix, but I was talking to a journalist who does teaching in the States, and he was saying his students have become, his younger students have become interested in The X-Files because they caught it on Netflix.
Mm-hmm.
So Netflix does open up old shows to new audiences, which I think is pretty cool.
That's one of the reasons why the show's actually back, to be honest.
Because I wrote a piece
about
this.
They saw how much attention Netflix had for the show.
Yeah, I wrote a piece about this for Make Use Of, which was inspired
by X-Files coming back. So that could be a great thing for Millennium.
So if Millennium is one, because that was one that a lot of people who replied to the post wanted.
And also, so people are aware, the first four seasons of The X-Files were shot on 35mm film, while the later seasons were shot on proper widescreen 16:9 film, although they weren't aired. I think only season 8 and 9 were aired in widescreen on TV. But they always protected the TV show from season 1 to 4, knowing that one day TV was going to go widescreen. They knew that it was going to happen. So if they protected Millennium the same way, and Millennium starts to gather that much attention, there's the possibility that that show could even be enhanced and for the HD world as well. And that would be, I don't know, it would be a great new... I'll put it to you this way. If you loved Millennium and you want to just continue watching it and enjoy it, as I do The X-Files, watching these transfers of The X-Files, which are HD widescreen now, it's kind of like rediscovering the show. So bringing the show to Netflix for Millennium would be introducing it to new audiences. And even reintroducing it to those who already love it. I think that'd be a great
thing.
Well,
it's a funny thing.
That's a possibility.
I mean, I've said in so many interviews now, when people ask me this, but, you know, the thing about Millennium, which is always very funny, is at the time it was considered absurd because it was, as many journalists said, it's just like a serial killer of the week show. Each week it's a serial killer. Who wants to watch that? And, you know, 15 years later, majority of Fox shows are criminal dramas about serial killers every week, and even one that was about a serial killer every week called Dexter. So it's just funny how things from a critical reception are criticized at one point and then become established later on. But no, it's a good show. The other thing I was going to recommend is, if you've not seen it, Resurrection of the Daleks, because I think it probably would help if you've got any little kids. It gives them a bit of backbone, I'm sure.
Just on the matter
Give them
of that,
fear. Get them fearing now, because they're going to need a lot of fear later on, because it's, you know, things
are
going to get worse. Yeah. So,
you know, one of the patients at my work Just told me that her daughter just got into Doctor Who thanks to Disney.
I thought you were going to say thanks to the podcast. Then.
What's that?
I thought you were going to say thanks to the podcast.
No, no. Well, no, the funny thing is she came into work one day and she told her mom that I looked like Doctor Who because, as you guys know, I cosplay David Tennant. Yeah. And so that sparked us talking and so on. Well, this girl, she's 9 years old and she loves the show already. She's just totally into it. But her mom was a little cautious of her watching it. She said she didn't know if that's a show her kid should be watching. And all I had to say to her was like, look, aside from the episode Blink, I can't think of another episode. And I probably maybe should have said Midnight too. But aside from that, I can't think of another episode that might be a tad too much for a kid. But otherwise, it's airing on Disney. I can't see them airing something on their channel that they don't think is like child appropriate as well, you know. But
it's actually an interesting question for another podcast, probably, is which shows are not suitable for kids in Doctor Who? Because I mean, several probably I can think of.
Well, that's next week sorted out.
There you go.
Yeah. So maybe look at that next week. Who knows?
Okay.
But no, I don't have any serious recommendations.
No, okay. Well, okay, so I was going to add something to something, but it's completely gone now. We went down that track there at the end, unfortunately. So, yeah, okay. So that's the end of the podcast. I'd like to thank... there is one other thing, which isn't what I'd forgotten, but it is something else that I've forgotten, but I've fortunately remembered. We've started the fan fiction on Casterbus today. So throughout this week, there are five... Flash, that's Flash with an F, fiction stories, very short stories. Just gauge the mood on fiction at Casterbus, because it is something that we've kind of been thinking. I mean, Brian and I talked about having stories on Casterbus many, when Anthony was still involved, if I remember rightly, Mr. T. So we're we're trying them out this week. There's one every day. They all have a running theme, which is Mars. We've got some lovely artwork to go with them. Do check those out and let us know what you think of them. But that does bring us to the end of this week's Casterbus podcast with a K. Thank you to James. Thank you to Brian. And thank you to Chewbacca. And we will be back with you next week. Until then, it's goodbye.
You've been listening to the Casterbus Podcast. The Podcast with a K. With Christian Holly, James McLean, and Brian Terranova.